Is it your contention that you can prove damages outside the underlying criminal action?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if you can prove damages, then ergo, you don't need an underlying criminal conviction?
That's our position.
And then if you prove damages, you get what? Treble that pursuant to the statute?
They would be trebled pursuant to the statute.
Why shouldn't there be an underlying conviction to be certain that damage was caused and responsibility was properly accorded?
Well, if the damages in this case were assessed at $10,000, at the time the cause of action arose, the criminal action would have been a minor misdemeanor. So the defendant, if you want to call him that, whether he's civil or criminal, would have had no right to a jury trial. I happen to be a part-time municipal judge, and without saying any secrets, sometimes the convictions of minor misdemeanors do not rise to the level of a murder trial. The actions are essentially summary. In most cases, the defendants plead guilty, not realizing, or no contest, not realizing they're laying way to other penalties.
Sounds to me like you're making an argument on behalf of defendant.
No, Your Honor, not at all.
Well, the defendant would be the one entitled to a jury trial.
Well, the jury trial would come on the damages. The point I'm trying to make is obviously the damages where they're trebled are not assessed in any criminal proceeding. In a minor misdemeanor, you wouldn't assess $10,000, let alone $30,000 worth of damages. The action would be limited to whether the defendant did recklessly cause or cut the timber, vines, whatever the shrubs, whatever the allegations of the complaint are.
Well, a minor misdemeanor running a stop sign, for which the penalty might be $100, can be the predicate now for an underlying vehicular homicide case. You don't always determine the result of a case by virtue of the amount of damages assessed, do you?
Well, the vehicular homicide would be an additional criminal action in which the defendant would have a right to a jury trial. And, of course, proof beyond a reasonable
doubt. So you are arguing for the defendant. The defendant in your case ought to have the right to a trial by jury.
Well, in my case, Your Honor, the defendant had a right to trial by jury, and he was tried by jury in the civil action.
Mm-hmm. Why should there be, counsel? That brings us to the other troubling issue, which is there is a historical common law cause of action for this kind of infringement, a trespass action, for which there is a measure of damages different than you argue is put forth in this statute. Treble damages is much better, isn't it, than the measure
certainly,
of damages
Your Honor,
for a regular common law trespass?
The point I was trying to make to start with was that the common law damages are inadequate in most of these cases.
But that's what do you say about the rationale for the General Assembly? You're essentially arguing that they've instituted a new civil cause of action with treble damages for this sort of trespass, and it overlaps with the existing cause of action, common law cause of action for trespass?
Well, in a sense, Your Honor, I don't believe it's a new cause of action. I think it's a new remedy,
okay,
an additional remedy.
So
now,
it's
there
just
is
a
the
new
additional
measure,
element of recklessness.
Counsel, isn't it what you're really arguing? It's a new measure of damages?
Essentially.
All right. And why would we have two different measures of damages for the same action?
Well, the common law makes no provision, or the weight of authority in common law, although there are exceptions, make no provision for what happens when the utility company comes in and tears your shrubbery out along your property in order to run a new electric line or water line. The common law measure of damages would be the decrease in value of your property, and in most cases it's You can't get an appraiser with a straight face to say it's decreased, even though the value to you may be it shuts off the view of your neighbor's garage or swimming pool.
But isn't the heart of this case, aren't we, to determine whether there has to be a violation, a conviction on the criminal charge? And what I'm troubled by is that second paragraph where it says, whoever violates this section. Now, how can you have anyone violating it without a conviction? That's what I would like to hear you address. Because you're saying this is an independent civil action, you don't need a conviction, but we still are faced with those words, whoever violates this section.
Well, if I'm driving home and I slow down for a traffic light out here and somebody runs into me from the rear, I've got a right of action against them, and I have the benefit of negligence per se for hitting the failing to stop within the sure clear distance, regardless of whether they're ticketed or not. That's the only answer I can give
you. So you're saying the violation occurs when those shrubs are cut down or when the trees...
The violation occurs. It doesn't say conviction.
It doesn't say conviction. And I was wondering if they're synonymous conviction.
Not
violation.
In my opinion, Your Honor. Of course, if they're synonymous, then I would not win this case.
Thank you.
The common law remedy does not take into account the... value of the particular shrubs to the owner. And many of these cases arise when it's a residential property and a comparatively small damage will to the owner consist of a considerable problem. There's no way you can transplant a 40-foot tree economically. It appears to me that the legislature, by providing for this trebling of damages, was giving an additional remedy for what was a common law trespass with the additional requirement that there be a reckless and not merely negligent trespass.
Does the remedy apply irrespective of the nature of the use of the property?
Yes.
For
this particular property was agriculture.
Right. In this particular property, it was the back of their wood lot, but your clients indicated they took nature walks and those kinds of things. But if it were in a remote and inaccessible area where the property owner didn't utilize it at all, would the treble damages still be available?
The trebling, I believe, would be available. The damages might be much less. The statute doesn't provide it has to be a residential property or a farm property or a commercial property. I think since this is a relatively simple thing, I'll turn it over to Mr. Cole.
Can you prove violate, the word
I'm sorry,
violates?
Your Honor.
Can you prove the word violates in the civil action? Is that your contention? Because usually when we say violate the statute, we mean, or violate the rule, there has to be some conviction or finding that violation has occurred.
Well, you can find a violation of a traffic law in a civil action. That's very common, whether or not there was a prosecution.
Your assured clear distance example.
Assured clear distance example.
So you show that, so you're saying you can show a violation of the statute in the civil case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hafner. Mr. Koff.
Thank you. Good morning. Please the court, Mr. Hafner. The appellee obviously contends that a criminal conviction is required under 901.51 before treble damages can be imposed. We do not agree that this creates a new remedy. The remedy that was involved here was a common law action, a trespass. In the example that was used in the discussion just moments ago between counsel and Justice Douglas, in a negligence per se case where you prove a violation of sure clear distance, that is an element or a means of proving negligence, but you do not get the penalty that is provided for violation of the assured clear distance statute, which is generally a minor misdemeanor. Yes, examples of violation of codes can be admissible in civil cases, but the penalties are not imposed by the jury. In this case, it's quite clear, 901.
Counsel.
Yes.
I cannot put my finger on it, but I thought that in reading these briefs, they're either in the Court of Appeals opinion or one of the underlying opinions, there were several examples of the choice of the verb violate in strictly civil cases. Do you remember seeing that? I can't put my
I believe that was in Mr. Happner's brief, I believe.
Oh, in the brief, not
yes.
in the opinion. Okay.
In his argument that violates doesn't require criminal conviction.
Yeah.
We're saying the word violates, as used in 901.51, since it's a criminal penalty, because it does fit within the definition of a criminal penalty as a minor misdemeanor, means criminal conviction. In order to violate a criminal statute, you have to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem I see with the appellant's argument is that the common law action is trespass is a preponderance of the evidence. And there are different elements in 901.51, recklessly in particular, and that would require proof beyond a reasonable doubt because it is a criminal violation in this situation. We're saying that 901.51 is criminal because of two things. One, it says that in addition to the penalty provided in 901.99. So before you can even reach the issue of treble damages, you have to have a penalty. And obviously, in order for a penalty to be imposed under 901.99, there must be a conviction. I'm unaware of any authority in Ohio whereby you can impose a fine that is established by statute in a civil case. There has to be a criminal conviction.
You leave the availability of treble damages up to the discretion of the prosecutor, whether or not he charges that person with a criminal offense, and whether or not that person then is convicted of a criminal offense. Then and only then are you able to get treble damages.
Well, the legislature has made that choice because that's where they put it.
Do I get the succession correct or am I mistaken?
Well, I suppose it depends in each county whether the prosecutor is involved in the charging decision or not. As a minor misdemeanor, anyone can sign an affidavit in a municipal court and have the person brought before them. So I don't agree that it would be up to the discretion of the prosecutor.
Okay.
Typically, most counties, the prosecutor doesn't do intake review on minor misdemeanors.
Right.
So I think that argument, although it would appear at first blush to have validity and practicality, I don't think it's true.
Wouldn't the idea of treble damages, meaning three times more than the court finds was damaged, wouldn't that be inserted for egregious conduct on the defendant? In other words, he just didn't go in and cut a tree or two, and when he found out he was on the wrong property, he left. Remember the facts of this case, they told the man, you're on the wrong property, you better not cut those trees, and he cut down another 6 or 8 acres, and he didn't seem to care whether he's on the wrong property or not. Wouldn't the idea of treble damages go to the facts whether or not the actions of the trespasser was a little more than getting on the property by accident?
Well, I think the treble damages are imposed because it's a criminal violation, and that the legislature at the time that originally adopted it decided $100 penalty was not enough.
But
so we'll
put punishing the property owner for really egregious action. Just because the guy wasn't convicted of a criminal offense for that same activity, you're punishing him because that additional step was not taken, even though the activities of the person who trespassed was really terrible. You cannot get to treble damages unless you go further and prosecute criminally and get him convicted.
Oh, I disagree with that. We have the common law action of trespass and punitive damages, which actually would require less proof, because in order to impose liability under 901.51, if he is going to be held liable for violating it, he must be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Whereas in a common law trespass, it's a preponderance and then clear and convincing for punitive. So those are lesser standards, which makes it easier for the owner to go in and prove it.
Okay.
The second thing is, I see this the same as in a vehicular homicide case. Person is killed, there's no prosecution for one reason or another, or perhaps the person's prosecuted and found not guilty. The survivors can still file a wrongful death action. We have traditionally distinguished between criminal prosecution and common law actions. Obviously, wrongful death has some statutory procedures now, but the code is full of examples, and the law is full of examples of people who have been prosecuted either successfully or unsuccessfully. They still have to be prosecuted civilly to be liable in damages under the common law. So I see this as being a distinctly separate issue that is available to them under the criminal, if there is a criminal conviction, which rises to the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the elements of 901.51. Only then can there be an imposition of the treble damages. And it's in the conjunctive. It says, in addition to the penalty provided. So there has to have been that penalty imposed before you can get to the issue of treble damages.
So do you envision getting to treble damages in the criminal case?
Then? Yes. I would. The way I believe the statute is intended to work, the person's prosecuted or pleads guilty, then the court of jurisdiction, municipal or county court, has a hearing, at which time the victim presents the evidence through the prosecution or in person, however the court would handle it. As Mr. Hapner said, a lot of these cases, there's not even a major trial, and the defendant would have the opportunity to rebut that. We have those types of restitution hearings all the time now in the criminal code.
Who gets the money?
The victim. It says he's liable in damages. I think this is perhaps one of our earliest victim rights pieces of legislation that apparently has been overlooked for a long time.
Where do you find that in that statute, though? The money trickles down, if you will, to the victim.
Well, I don't.
Usually penalties that are in fact assessed in criminal cases go to the state.
And if that's the argument, then that's even stronger for the reason that he doesn't get to have it in the civil case. If that's what this statute, if this what this court feels
well,
it means,
it goes
to the
thing.
That's where
your argument, I think, goes. I don't know that I think,
I mean, literally, you're right. It doesn't say. But it does say liable and treble damages for the injury caused as opposed to imposing a fine. And that's the way I would read it, but obviously I'm not the court.
This is a certified conflict case to us, and I note in your brief, as I recollect, you don't discuss the conflict case of Miller out of the 12th District. What umbrage do you take with that case?
Well, I think it's just plain wrong.
Why?
Because they ignored the language of the statute, and I think went DeNoyer. They went back to DeNoyer v. Lamb, in which they basically put in the syllabus out of the First District that it did create a new civil remedy, but yet that case didn't even address the issue of the underlying conviction. It just said it did, and it was on a different issue. It was almost, I think, almost dicta. They really didn't analyze it.
And that the damages in Miller?
In Miller?
They went on and said the damages do what?
They treble.
Right.
Yeah, they agree that this do not need a criminal conviction.
And go to the victim.
Correct. But they were treating it as an independent civil action, which we don't
exactly.
feel, and
well,
we disagree with that.
But that's his position.
That's his position, yes.
It's an independent civil action, and I understand you think that the 12th District and maybe even the 1st District was wrong, but I'd really like to know why they were wrong, and is it your feeling that because they didn't discuss the underlying criminal conviction question?
I don't think they addressed it. They didn't address the issue of what is the standard of proof in a criminal case. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. So now we're going to be trying a common law case on different standards. The other issue is doubling up of the damages. In common law, they get punitive. Yeah, they also want to add an account on violation of this with treble. That was one of the things I raised in my motion to the trial court in response to the amended complaint was they're going to try to get two pieces of punitive damages, which would double the damages, which we felt was unconscionable, and the court struck this count.
Do you have any proof of that? Did he plead that?
He pleaded in his amended complaint. He pled count two, 901.51. We filed a motion to dismiss and to strike it, and the court struck it on the basis, not reaching the issue I just mentioned, but on the basis that a criminal conviction was required. I did assert that I felt that it was improper to seek both punitive for a common law trespass as well as treble damages for the same conduct under 901.51. And I did not feel that issue really hasn't been litigated because the court threw it out on the prior criminal conviction issue.
Counsel?
Yes.
The you know, your argument seems to me to be premised on the proposition that this is a criminal statute. And yet, the question you just explored with Justice Douglas about the difference between damages and fines, to me, maybe highlights a problem with the argument, and especially your reliance on in addition to, because in addition to could very well be, and it seems that almost that language, in addition to the penalty, all right, in .99, the statute then goes on to say, whoever violates this is liable in damages. So we say, can't that be read as a provision permitting a criminal sanction as well as damages, which we know is a term used for civil recovery for a plaintiff, not the state.
You could interpret it that way and say that if there is a conviction, then that gives a common law right of action in a jury trial. Yes, I mean, quite honestly, I didn't focus on that issue. It wasn't really litigated in an appellate court because we're arguing the prior conviction. But this court, I think, reasonably could say, yes, there must be a criminal conviction under 901.51, and the municipal or county court will enter a judgment of a fine. Then, if this court doesn't feel that it should be litigated at that level, it could then be pled by that victim in a civil cause of action as a count and argue it that way.
I'm really asking,
could go that way.
Okay, but you're not really even following how far I'm going. I'm saying that you would not have to have an underlying conviction, that these two are mutually exclusive remedies, wholly different. Penalty, criminal penalty, civil damages in that section. That's where you take issue. You say that it has to be, and I'm saying, can't that reasonably be a reading of that section?
No, I don't think it can be reasonable, and the reason I say it can't be reasonable is because the statute says in addition to the penalty.
Penalty.
That means there must have been a penalty imposed, has been a conviction of a violation of this statute.
We don't
have penalties if there's not a conviction.
Yeah. In addition to the penalty means that one is not, that one can't get either a penalty or damages. In addition is quite often read in the revised code to mean that we've got two separate, wholly independent remedies.
I'm not aware of that in criminal cases.
I wonder if you have examined the research, the code for like situations. And the only thing that's striking me, and I did not research it myself yet, but I think in the securities area, that there is in the same statute civil penalties as well as opportunities to seek a criminal conviction.
I didn't research the securities. My experience in that is limited, although I'm aware that there are a number of civil causes of action created for various security violations, both state and federal. And those seem to impose both and create both. But I did go through 29, I went through 9, I went through various criminal penalty statutes, and I found no other examples of independently created civil causes of action.
How about the civil rights chapter, 41-12-06, which says in addition to 41-12-99, where there may be a penalty for hate crimes?
There has been a conviction. Under 29.
Not necessarily. It says this is in addition to.
Well, that creates a civil cause of action. The title, and I forgot the title, but the civil rights cases create independent, I think, similar to the securities laws, independent private causes of action, regardless of whether there's been any prosecution for the civil rights, criminal civil rights violation. That's in a separate statute. But
if this were just a crime, wouldn't it be in 29?
Oh, no. No, there are a number of crimes in different sections that we prosecuted, particularly in the agricultural issue, livestock,
and
so forth.
Where they're cumulative.
I don't believe they're cumulative.
Okay.
I think it's in the conjunctive, in addition to penalty provided, whoever violates. We have to have a penalty, we have to have a violation. And the only way a violation can occur is if you've been convicted. And as I indicated, I'm not aware of any situation where a person who violates a statute can have a penalty imposed upon it in a civil case. There has to, that has to be by the court having jurisdiction of the criminal case.
Thank you, Mr. Cost.
Thank you.
Mr. Happner, you've saved almost 5 minutes of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to answer Justice Cook. We cited the definitions of violating conviction on page 5 of our brief, original brief. We think if the legislature had intended to make this a part of the penalty, they would have put it in section 901.99, providing the penalty for a violation of 901.51 shall be. And initially, when the revised code was adopted, the penalty was a fine of not less than $50 or more than $100. And back when we classified misdemeanors, I think in the early 70s, it was made a fourth degree misdemeanor.
Is there still a fine available for this type of conviction?
Yes, it's presently a fourth degree misdemeanor, which would mean a maximum fine of $250.
So you have the criminal conviction, you have the sentence, and you have a fine already available, which would, I think, then tend to support your argument that this is a civil remedy.
Well, that's our position. The fines obviously go to the state or the county. The section provides is liable and treble damages. Now, that's liable and damages are civil words. I wasn't aware that Mr. Koss was arguing that the municipal court would assess this as an additional fine and pay it into the treasury.
That's why I asked him.
I must have missed that in his brief, in all honesty. Initially, in both the Court of Appeals and the trial court, he made essentially the same argument that a criminal conviction is necessary.
That would be a two-step process, then. A criminal case first, and then a civil case in which you start out by a certified copy of the criminal conviction.
I would assume that if that's the way it would be done, the plaintiff or the injured party would file an action, civil action, alleging a certain amount of damages and alleging a conviction of this section as a basis for trebling the damages. If the damages were to be determined in the trial court, we would soon run into a situation exceeding the jurisdiction of the civil of the county and municipal courts, and then I don't know whether you'd have to have an indictment on a fourth degree misdemeanor.
Well, except that the statute doesn't give any discretion, does it? Whoever violates this section is liable in trouble damages for injury caused. Does that the General Assembly order that beyond the jurisdiction, the monetary jurisdiction of a municipal court, you think, or not?
Well, the monetary jurisdiction limit of the municipal court, except in Cleveland, at the present is $10,000.
But there's no limit.
Now 15, it's been amended.
It's 15.
Well, that's right. It was effective first this year, yes.
But there's no limit on what a judge can order as restitution in a criminal case, is there?
Restitution normally lies in felony cases, but when we order restitution in a misdemeanor case, usually on the basis of a condition of probation.
But you don't have a monetary limit on what amount of restitution you could order.
Well, we've never had a restitution in my experience as a practicing attorney in a misdemeanor that was more than a few hundred dollars. As I stated, Mr. Koss's argument does surprise me somewhat, but I don't really think it bears on the issue whether the damages would be determined in the criminal court or the civil court. I think this clearly is a civil action, and as a civil action, the word violate and placing it in the section that created the action, in my opinion at least, I concur with certainly agree with the 12th District. And the first district in their DeNoyer case, although in that particular case they said that treble damages didn't lie because it wasn't raised until the trial. or raised actually to the verdict. The,
I probably should have asked your worthy adversary this question, but it just occurs to me now. What if there's a prosecutor who refuses to bring an action for trespass? That leaves, if we hold...
That would foreclose any civil remedy.
You'd be out altogether.
Well, except the party who's been injured, as Mr. Koss said, I think if I understood his argument, can file an affidavit in municipal court, minor misdemeanor. Do you agree? Can file an affidavit in municipal court and have the process begun? Doesn't take the prosecutor to do that, does it?
Well, we have a municipal court prosecutor, the law director. And in most, I won't say in all courts, but most courts, they expect the prosecutor to pass on the affidavits before they're filed.
And the decision to prosecute is highly discretionary and unimpeachable or unattackable?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You have used your time, Mr. Hepner.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.